Hello, this is John Bowden from Bellowhead, and you're listening to Sheffield Live, number one for Sheffield music.
We're open for business live.
Good morning. It's just after 9 o'clock. It's Friday. It's the 7th of September 2018. I'm Jamie Veitch, your host for the next hour for Sheffield Live's business and social enterprise programme, Business Live. And we are broadcasting live from the Sheffield Live radio studio in the centre of Sheffield. Whether you're listening through 93.2 FM or through our internet live stream, the programme is also available as a podcast later on from the Sheffield Live website and Talking Podcast. Did you catch last Friday's show? If you didn't, you missed Jonathan Cook, and he was telling us all about Web Architects, the cooperative, and Principle 5, the Cooperative Support Centre. And he talked about a number of thriving co-ops here in Sheffield too. Now, if you missed that, then don't panic, because the podcast is, of course, up on the Sheffield Live website at sheffieldlive.org. Just go to radio shows, find Business Live, and you'll be able to find the programme from last week. Whilst you're there, of course, you'll also be able to find a fantastic and diverse range of exciting, wonderful music presented by Sheffield Live's wonderful presenters who all love the music that they play. So go on, explore and enjoy. But that podcast was then, this is now. Who is on today? Well, I'm delighted that we have some fantastic live studio guests here with us, and we have Madge Willard and Steve Pipe in the studio. And so we're going to talk with both of them in the programme. Madge first, Steve in a few minutes. But before we do, what's been going on in business and in social enterprise? What's been going on with you? What have you been up to? You can get in touch. You can let me know. You can send a text message to 07904 272 200. You can send an email to jamie@sheffieldlive.org. You can find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. You can find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. Because whether you're running or starting a business or social enterprise, we're always keen to hear from you. And a quick heads up, it's the deadline to apply for the Sheffield Business Awards on Monday the 10th of September. So you don't have long, and there are quite a wide range of categories to apply for. I was particularly interested in the category for businesses doing social good here in Sheffield, and I'd love it if when I go along to the Sheffield Business Awards to see a wonderful range of businesses showing the fantastic work that they do and social enterprises here in the city that are making Sheffield an even better place. So get your application in now. I think without further ado, it's time to turn to our first guest, and Madge Willard is in the studio with us. Madge,
hello.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks very much for having me in. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks so much for coming in. I know you've been on Sheffield Live in the past, but not on my programme.
That's right, yeah.
So great to welcome you back to the studio. So tell us about yourself, Madge. Who are you? What do you do? I know, but I'd love to hear more.
Yeah, I'm a piano teacher. I work locally at a place called Hagler's Corner, which is on Queen's Road. I rent a studio there. I've actually been teaching for over 20 years now since I left college, so I'm pretty experienced at what I do. I'm also a peripatetic teacher. I work in three local schools, St. Teresa's, Mundella and Outwood Academy.
Grand. Yeah. Okay, super. And you mentioned you have a studio in Hagler's Corner.
That's right.
What a lovely spot.
It is, yeah.
And I think I've been to a gig there, which I really enjoyed.
Yeah, it's a great place for small businesses. There's all sorts going on there. There's yoga classes. There's a cafe and bar. There's some designers, flower arrangers, sewing people. So there's all sorts going on there.
Grand, super. And so you teach people, do you teach beginners? Do you teach people who are perhaps returning to the piano as adults who learnt when they were children?
Yeah, I teach all of those. And obviously I have a lot of beginners because people have to start somewhere. I take people from age 6 upwards. I have quite a lot of adults. Probably over half my private students are adults. Some of those played when they were young and others have never played at all before. I have some people in their 60s and 70s who want to take up a hobby in retirement. I have people who've been coming a number of years and have gone gone up the exam system and gone up the grades. A few have got as far as grade 8, which is the top grade.
Yes.
And I teach different styles of music. I'm classically trained, but I also teach pop and jazz, and I try and tailor the lessons to individual needs. So I ask people what music they're interested in, and I won't want to force them down a classical route if they're interested in jazz.
And that's really important in learning an instrument and sticking with it and enjoying it.
Yeah, you have to do music that motivates you.
Yeah, great. So do you find that some people are motivated by things like exams and see exams? I mean, you said you've had people get to grade 8 level, and some see those as motivation in itself, and others see sort of, I'd love to play a particular piece, and that's a motivation. So
some people don't go down the exam route at all because a lot of people get too nervous in exams, or they don't want that sort of pressure, or they find the exam system too dry, which it is a little bit. But exams also can be a good goal to work towards.
Yes.
And so there's pros and cons towards them. But yeah, some people want to play a particular piece, or some people want to learn something off YouTube. There's a lot of that going on these days.
Yes, absolutely. Indeed. And so your approach to teaching is sort of centred on the person's particular bespoke needs. It's not a sort of one-size-fits-all approach.
That's right.
Right, grand.
And I'm particularly interested in teaching people with additional needs. I teach a few people on the autism spectrum, which is very interesting indeed, because I find they often have a fascination with music and an affinity, which is very fun to teach.
Yes, yes. So that must be really, really rewarding.
It is, some of the most rewarding teaching I've done.
Yeah, great. And some teachers perhaps don't have the expertise or the knowledge to make that's so rewarding, I imagine.
No.
Yeah. So tell me more about your approach to teaching then. I mean, you're clearly classically trained, but very clearly focused on each pupil's particular needs. What was it that led you to becoming a music teacher as opposed to someone who loves music and plays music for themselves, which I'm sure you continue to do too?
Well, music was always the thing that I did through childhood. It was my passion. I was very lucky to go to a secondary school in London, which had a special music department and top class tuition. And then I went on to do a music degree at Cambridge University. And after that, I didn't really know what I was going to end up doing. So I did a PGCE in primary teaching. So I'm a trained primary teacher, but I haven't actually worked in that field because I didn't think classroom teaching would be for me. Too much handling 30 kids at once.
Yes.
And so I went down the one-to-one teaching route, and that's just always what I've done.
Right, grand. And you said you've been doing it for 20...
since I left college, in fact, so over 20 years,
Yeah, super. And I suppose one thing that I know from talking with many music teachers is that it can sometimes be difficult to continue your personal playing. How does that work for you? Do you get time to continually practice and develop pieces that you want to learn and that you enjoy, or does that sometimes get pushed to the back of the queue?
Yeah, certainly I don't have as much time as I'd like. I do make a clear rule that I never teach at weekends, and I never teach after 7:30 p.m. in the evenings, because I need my own life. And I also do a bit of singer-songwriting, which is kind of separate from my work, a different style of music. And I perform with my wife on bass guitar. So so we do a bit of that. We're performing at a festival at Hagler's Corner coming up very soon, which is called Diversity Fest.
Wonderful.
It's on Sunday the 30th of September, and it's free. So if you want to come along and hear myself and about 40 others perform at that.
Sounds absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
Is that daytime, evening?
It's 1 till 9. 9 p.m. so all day.
So that's 1 till 9 at Hagler's Corner on Sunday the 30th.
That's right.
Brilliant. Great. Well, that sounds exciting. And so you will have a range of performances on during the whole day there.
There's all sorts. There's poetry, there's dancing, there's choirs, drummers, all sorts of things.
Excellent. Superb. So I wonder if we'll give that another mention as well when we finish the interview, just so that we can remind folk it's on. And find out more. But I thought it might be helpful if you gave some tips for people learning music in terms of how to find a teacher, how to find a piano teacher, mm-hmm. or a teacher of any instrument who will fit with the music that they want to learn. You know, mm-hmm. it can sometimes be difficult for people to find a teacher
yeah.
who is as focused on the person's mm-hmm. individual needs as you clearly are. So. Yeah.
Well, I try to be. Obviously, I won't be the right teacher for every student. I think you have to find a match for you and what fits your personality.
Yes, mm. yeah. And what about tips in terms of learning music? I mean, loads of people these days are sort of trying to teach themselves mm-hmm. using YouTube videos.
Yeah.
And for some music teachers, I guess that must be quite worrying. But for others, it's a case of, well, people have always tried to mm-hmm. teach themselves, you know, from books or whatever. First of all, does it concern you that people try to learn from, say, a YouTube video? Does that, do you think, take potential students away from you as a teacher?
Yes, it probably does. But I think it can be a good thing. I've seen people do wonderful things from YouTube and
yes.
been quite impressed at some of the things that people have taught themselves. And obviously, they do need the technical side of it. I've seen people trying to play with two fingers from a YouTube video. You do yes. need to use all five. There's not really any way around that, or 10 should I say.
Yeah, indeed.
And people find it hard to coordinate their two hands without having had proper lessons, so yes, I would say it is important to get the lessons as well, but yes, do the YouTube stuff too.
Yes. Great stuff. And what about tips for other music teachers? I mean, you and I have mm-hmm. met virtually through a fantastic Twitter group.
Yeah, that's right, Piano Teachers Hour.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's been brilliant to connect with other teachers through Twitter.
Yes.
I think it is really important to connect with other teachers because it can be quite an isolating profession when you're always on your own with a student in the room.
Yes.
There's that, and there's an EPTA group in Sheffield, that's European Piano Teachers Association. We meet at teachers' houses once every few months, and that's been very useful.
So that's been particularly helpful for you mm-hmm. as well.
And I subscribe to the Pianist magazine,
yeah,
and that has a lot of useful tips.
So all this will help people who, by the nature of the work that you do, it can be isolating. I mean, of course, you're seeing students mm-hmm. all the time,
yeah.
but in terms of isolated from peers, mm-hmm. this helps you connect with other teachers.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Grand. Any other tips that you'd give to people who are, for example, at an earlier stage than you in working as mm-hmm. a music teacher or considering it mm-hmm. as a career? So someone who's coming out of university mm. as you were considering teaching mm. and deciding to go down the musical instrument teaching route, mm. an accomplished musician who is looking at it. What do you know now that you wish you'd known when you started?
Oh, that's a hard one.
It's a tough one, that, yeah.
Well, I'd just like to give an example of one student I had who, it was about 10 years old and he failed his grade 2, and I thought, oh, this student's not really going to go very far. He didn't really show much potential. But then we switched over to doing jazz music and something really clicked with him. And then he went on to pass his grade 8 jazz exam, which you can do with the London College, and then he went on to get a job in playing in a cafe bar semi-professionally. So for someone like him, I would say just don't give up on a student. You don't know where they're going to go, you don't know what's going to turn them around, and something like that could happen.
What a lovely story.
Mm, yeah.
That's absolutely fantastic. So you're here because you offer private teaching mm-hmm. to folk at Haggler's Corner. So anyone listening to the show who's considering learning the piano, mm-hmm. they now know where to come.
Yeah.
How do folk get in touch with you, Madge?
Well, I have a website. My web address is mwoolard.webs.com, and you spell Woolard with two O's and two L's, so that's mwoolard.webs.com.
Grand, super. And all your contact details are there on there. Mm-hmm. Showcases the type of work you do, yeah, and so on. And you're on Twitter as well.
I am, yes. My Twitter handle is at Funky Piano. That's funk, then IE, then piano.
Super. That's brilliant. So I will tweet those links as well to your website, mm-hmm, and to your Twitter handle too. Now, listeners, you don't have to be a Twitter user yourself, but you can simply look up Sheffield Live or look up Jamie Veitch on Twitter to follow the links to anything that we mention in the radio show today, and you'll be able to find Funky Piano. You'll be able to find Madge Willard there. So, Madge, do you want to just give the Diversity Festival another mention? That's on the 30th of September, and you'll be performing there yourself.
Yeah, that's
with
right.
Your wife,
I think myself and my wife are performing around 5 o'clock in the downstairs bar.
Right, grand. Now I'm going to try and get along to that.
You.
That sounds absolutely fantastic. And it's a free event.
It is, yeah.
And there's a whole range of other performances, music, spoken word, poetry, and much, much more on the day too. And your website address, one last go. Let's give it a good plug.
mwoolard.webs.com.
Brilliant. Well, Madge, it's been a real pleasure to speak with you today. Thank you,
it's
so
been
much
lovely
for coming in and talking with us on the show. Madge Willard, thank you.
Yeah.
And you're listening to Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme, with me, Jamie Veitch. We're going to take a quick break for a quick track of music. This is the acclaimed classical guitarist Alison Smith with a track called Lou Carrar.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.
This is Business Live, Sheffield Live's weekly business and social enterprise programme, with me, Jamie Veitch. Are you doing something really fascinating, really innovative, really exciting? Would you like to be on the show? Well, get in touch. Drop me an email, jamie@sheffieldlive.org. Text 07904 272 200. Find me, Jamie Veitch, on Twitter. Find Sheffield Live on Twitter as well. And we've been hearing today from Madge Willard. She's a piano teacher in Sheffield. She's also performing at the upcoming Diversity Festival on the 30th of September, so you'll be able to catch her there. If you've only just tuned in and you've missed the interview with Madge, then don't panic. The podcast will be up on the Sheffield Live website later on. Now, I have brought an accountant with a heart, with a soul, into the studio, and he is here. Steve Pipe, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Thank you so much for coming in. So I've given you a very, very brief introduction, but tell me about you. You're an accountant. You're so much more.
Well, the accountant bit's factually accurate. I'm 57, live in Leeds, although my business used to be based here in Sheffield. I am a football fan. I play the guitar terribly badly. I play tennis a little bit better, and I'm working towards retirement in a few years' time, and I'm determined to make a real difference before I get there.
Okay, great. And that was a wonderful and succinct description. Guitar really badly. I bet you're being quite modest.
No, really badly. Trust me.
You've also written 7 books. You've won numerous awards, something in the region of 14 awards, I believe.
And strangely, somehow, I've no idea, but yeah.
And you're well known within accountancy and wider business for supporting other accountants too, and helping and having helped numerous accountants to run their own practices, their own businesses, in a more successful or more resilient way as well. So I think it's really interesting what you've done. So tell us a little bit more about that entrepreneurial career.
Well, I did economics at university. I can come back to that because that's actually really rather important. Became an accountant because I wanted to get married, and we were living in Wakefield at the time, and there were no jobs for economists in Wakefield. And loved accountancy. Think that actually being an accountant is a really wonderful and potentially profoundly valuable thing to do.
Yes.
Many accountants, however, are so busy that they don't have enough time to really make enough of a difference to their clients and to the wider world. And they needed some help to try and focus their efforts so they were more valuable and ultimately also more profitable, more rewarding, emotionally and financially. The career path that I took to get there, I went from university to trained as an accountant in Leeds. Then moved into Kodak. I was the head of finance for 140 million division of Kodak well before it went bust. Not my responsibility, I promise. And then we moved up
That's
here.
That's good to know.
We had twins. They're now 24 years old. We moved from the south, which is where I come from, back up here to Yorkshire, which is where my wife comes from. And at that point, I refocused my efforts from working from big corporates to work to setting up my own small accounting firm and then a little business supporting accountants, which actually grew to 40 people. We were here in the Don Valley, and at one point we were up to 40 people. I'd always said on stage I was going to retire. We ran lots of seminars, so when I say on stage, when I was talking to groups, I said I was going to retire at 50, got to just before my 50th birthday, and the rest of the team are going, so what's happening? Are you leaving? Are you actually retiring? And I didn't know what not working would feel like. So I took a 3-month sabbatical, not to go on holiday, just to live in Leeds and see what not working felt like. And there were large parts of it I really enjoyed, but I thought this is going to drive me stir crazy. So I changed my role within the business at that time. I stepped down from being an employee and a director. I'm no longer a shareholder either. The management team bought my shares from me, and I moved into a kind of ambassador kind of role. I'm really passionate about what they do. They're now based in Marlborough. But I have a little bit more detachment so that I can focus on the things that matter the most to me, which is helping accountants, but through accountants, making a greater difference to the world.
Yes, and we are going to come on to that, because that is fascinating stuff. So brilliant, what a diverse and interesting career path, and great to hear about that. But it's not only about work for you, is it? There is play as well, not only inflicting the guitar playing on all and sundry.
Yeah, well, actually, I don't inflict the guitar playing on anybody.
anyone other than yourself?
Yeah, well, even not very often on me. There was one moment a few years ago when I thought that playing the guitar would be my real differentiator as a speaker, because I'd seen the brilliant Eric Clapton tribute artist in Leeds, and I contacted him and said, can we play together, just the once? And we were running a two-day conference. I had my midlife crisis involved buying a Fender Stratocaster guitar, which is the classic electric guitar, and a great amplifier to go with it. You know, other people have Harley Davidsons, this was mine. And so we had this two-day conference where the guitar was on stage, on a stand, the whole day long. And every time I came on and off as sort of the linking person, the riff from Layla would play. Everybody knows it did a little that one, although it sounds much better than that. Anyway, and then in the gala dinner in the evening, I got on stage with a 3-piece band and started to play Layla badly, which is the only way I can play it. So played the opening riff of Layla really, really badly and stopped. I think we need some help. Eric, can you come out and help me? And this guy called Mike Hall, who's a Geordie, comes from behind the stage with his guitar plugged in, you know, with a radio mic thing, and he blasts out, and he looks exactly like Clapton. And then we play two Clapton songs with me soloing on Layla. And the audience are just, flipping heck, there's Eric Clapton here in, it was Birmingham, the NEC in Birmingham. And there's video evidence of this. This is the only time I have ever played in public, but twice, so I'll tell you about the second time in a second. That one went so well, I thought, this is going to be my party piece. Every time I go on stage, I'll have the guitar on stage, and I kind of have a 3-piece band each time, so I'll have the backing track, the karaoke backing track, and I'll play over the top of it. And I learned a really valuable lesson. The next time, which was in Lincolnshire, on stage, run a seminar, at the end played, got ready to play later, thinking it'll go as well as the first time. Well, there was no alcohol involved that time, so this made a difference. But secondly, the real lesson I learned was, if you have a real band of musicians around you, that's supportive. If you're in a team environment and they can adapt according to what works or doesn't, that's wonderful. If you stand on stage with a backing track, which is completely unforgiving, and you do not hit a single note correctly for 3.5 minutes, the excruciating embarrassment.
Oh, yes.
Is just, and I was so confident after the first time, I didn't plan if it goes badly, this is what I'll say that will be humorous and makes a, you know, I intended it to go badly. I didn't. So I had absolutely nothing to say, nowhere to hide. And I'm never, ever going to do that again. Two public performances, that's it.
Fair enough. Well, I can tell you, I retired from a career as a children's magician, which actually helped pay my way through university. But I retired from a career as a children's magician halfway through a magic show. That tells you something, doesn't it?
Same experience, but I couldn't get off stage.
But no, that's fascinating. The Clapton story there. But as you say, a band of live musicians, wonderfully accommodating, flexible, and so
a
on.
A team around you, as opposed to splendid isolation, is so much better.
Well, there's a lovely metaphor there for business too. And apart from guitar, you've mentioned children and twins. You've mentioned tennis briefly. You're a keen traveller as well.
Oh, so. We love travelling. Yeah, we have three kids. They're adult children now. They're 24-year-old twins and 27-year-old oldest daughter who gets married next year. They all live in Yorkshire too. So yeah, and I play tennis really badly. I don't think I've won a single set all year.
Right.
So yeah, that's a metric that I think I'm proud of. Yeah.
You must be really.
I try.
You must be really popular.
I still
with
come
your,
out smiling. They love playing against me. Yeah.
Fantastic. So we quite often ask people on this programme about where they've sought inspiration, whether that's inspiration in terms of a figure, a person, or inspiration in terms of advice from institutions, from organisations, from businesses. So what about you, Steve, in terms of who has inspired you?
I mean, over the years, there will have been many inspirations from personal and family and books I've read and people I've seen on telly, but unquestionably, and there are two people, but they come as a package, really. The two people that have inspired me most are called Paul Dunn and Masami Sato. Now, Paul was born in Dover, lived much of his life in Australia, now based in Singapore. Masami was born in Japan, now based in Singapore. And they are together in Singapore, spearheading something which really does inspire me. And they inspire me personally, but what they are doing and the impact that it's had, changing close to 160 million lives. Because they set up a movement called B1G1. And B1G1 is a community of businesses around the world who believe that we can step up and do something about the UN Global Goals. I'm wearing the UN Global Goals badge because I believe passionately that we all have a responsibility to do what we can to make the world better and to tackle those goals. I mean, every civilized country in the world got together and supported a set of 17 goals to be achieved by 2030. And you know, as of a few months ago, the report says we are still well behind where we need to be. So it's up to each of us to do what we can. And what B1G1, what Paul and Masami have created, is a mechanism that makes it remarkably easy for businesses to get involved, to step up, no matter what they do, no matter where they are, no matter how big or small they are, what stage of their development, we each can do something. And the cumulative, the combined impact of us each doing what we can really start to change the world. So one of the things I love about what they do and why I think it's so brilliantly inspiring, and this is coming as an accountant, is that they keep the score by measuring the number of smiles. Well, smiles are a metaphor, but the number of micro-impacts. So, for example, if there's a project in Africa where it's going to cost £1,000 to put in a well in a village, they'll say, well, how many people are going to benefit from that well over how many years? And they'll work out effectively the cost of funding one day's worth of water for one person.
Yes.
And you can fund... You can choose, if you choose to, you can give, it's a cent, one US cent, to fund one day's worth of water for someone in Africa. Now, this could be a young girl who might otherwise have to spend two, three, four hours a day going backwards and forwards to a distant well, backbreaking work, bringing the water back, and consequently doesn't have time for an education, can't lift herself and her family up. And yet, for 1 cent, we can step in and make that well possible in the village and therefore change her life. And so they've identified thousands of projects, but brilliantly have broken down the funding cost into the smallest common denominator. So one day's worth of water, or one day's worth of access to a library book, or one day's worth of education. And there are almost 160 million of those impacts now that have been created across the world by small businesses. I mean, so far there are 2,500 or so businesses in that movement. 2,500 million businesses have created almost 160 million smiles, 160 million micro impacts. Just imagine if there were 250,000 businesses or 25 million businesses. And really that's what excites me, is that trying to play my small part in sharing that message, getting people following on from the inspiration that Paul and Masami have created there, to change the world, one little micro impact, one smile, maybe 1 cent at a time. Doesn't matter how big or small the business is, everybody can get involved in that kind of way. I think it's genius.
So this is amazing. 160 million impacts from a relatively small number of participants.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
That's
the extraordinary thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, and just imagine what scope there is for that to just change everything, to make everything better. There's a lovely phrase, you know, businesses that do good do better. And I think all of the evidence, and as an economist, as an accountant, you know, we come from a position of natural scepticism. For me, the case for getting involved is overwhelming on two levels. It's overwhelming on an emotional, as a human being level. But actually, the evidence, the business case for being a business for good, is equally overwhelming. In fact, more so.
Yes.
The more I've looked at the research that's out there, and the more I've done my own research. So, for example, on Wednesday, I was down in Corby. I had the pleasure of presenting to a bunch of about 25 business owners. And I did this little exercise where I said, okay, there are two coffee shops. Imagine they're side by side. There are actually several coffee shops under where we're sitting here, aren't there? Imagine there are two identical coffee shops and they both sell the same equally good coffee in the same equally good environment. You go to that coffee shop and you just get coffee. You go to that coffee shop for the same price, for the same equally good coffee. You buy a cup of coffee, but you are also funding a day's worth of water for that young girl in Malawi.
Yes.
So that instead of her having to walk for hours to bring water back to the village that day, you are making it possible for her to get the water in the village, and therefore she gets education and she can lift herself up and everything gets better. You have a choice between these two coffee shops. It's the same coffee, it's the same price, but one of those coffee shops changes a life as well as giving you your drink. Which one you're going to go to? And physically I get them to go from one side of the, go over to that side if you go to the coffee shop with just the coffee, go to that side if you go to the coffee shop with the water, and everybody goes there. So you just imagine what that means. That means that when you build being good, when you visibly are a business for good, when what your business does is change lives, in this case it's coffee and water, it doesn't have to be coffee or water, it can be in any other way. But when you are a business that, as an automatic byproduct of what you do, the world gets a little bit better in one of these small measurable ways, what happens is you get the equivalent of everybody coming to your coffee shop. And in this room, we actually had one person on that route, one side, who'd misunderstood, and we had 30 on that side. And that's an incredibly... That was, you can say, well, that's that group of people down in Northamptonshire. But actually, the evidence, the research elsewhere, is that kind of effect comes through over and over and again in lots of different studies, in lots of different ways. You know, they see that, you know, the evidence shows that businesses that do good, their customers are willing to pay more.
Yes.
Their customers are much more likely to talk about them, so you get the word of mouth advertising. They're much more likely to come back. The team are much more likely to go the extra mile. And I'd literally travelled from Leeds, got up at 4:30 in the morning to go to Corby. I wasn't getting a speaking fee for going there, but I went literally the extra mile because it mattered,
yes,
because it was worth doing. And you get that same effect across your business if you are connected in a way that everybody understands, with a higher purpose, with some kind of, you know, feeling of there is a reason we do this. We want to actually sell more coffee in the coffee,
yes,
shop example, because we know that the more cups of coffee we sell, the more young girls we can change the lives of.
And that
just works at a commercial level and at an emotional, humanitarian level brilliantly well.
Well, it does, doesn't it? And this is absolutely fascinating how we have now the congruence of the hard-headed business people saying, well, this is good for business being good, and we have the people who say this is good for society, we need to do this,
yeah,
for whatever reason this is good.
Mm-hmm.
And whether that's in impact investing, where impact investors deploying something in the region of 17 or 20% more into investments, and we're talking billions and billions of pounds across the world, that have a social return as well as a financial return. And for some of them, they're doing it because they want their money to do good, and for others, they're putting their money into impact investing because it's the best financial return for them. But, you know, either way, we seem to have people coming from whatever angle going, good business is the way
to do business.
Yeah.
Businesses that do good do better. I think that's a lovely way of putting it. Not my phrase, picked it up from someone else. It's just everything I see, just it screams out that the the business, the humanitarian, everything pulls, that works together. It's not a, I can do this at my expense. I can do this and make the world better, and in the process also make my business better. Now, even if it weren't the case that there was a commercial payback, we should still be doing good.
Yes.
But if you add that onto it, then there is no reason not to, is it? You know, if that makes sense, yeah.
Absolutely.
It's crazy not to.
Yeah. It's crazy not to, indeed. So the B1G1 movement is now poised, I think. I mean, I've been hugely impressed with those impacts, those 160 million mm-hmm. micro-impacts, or smiles, yeah, yeah. whatever you like to call mm-hmm. them, and making what an enormous life-changing, truly life-changing difference. But as we both talked about earlier, this is from a relatively small number of participants.
Yeah, yeah.
This could go big, and you've been encouraging people, you've been encouraging accountants, to seize the metal here, to do it themselves,
for sure.
To participate and to encourage this to clients. We'll come on to that in a moment or two, if that's okay,
mm-hmm.
because big message, big call to action on that. But Steve, you alluded to university and education earlier on, and your own training, your own education, 2 degrees. But were they a good use of time?
Well, I did 2 degrees because I didn't know what to do as a job, and back in those days, you could get funding to do a master. So I did economics at York initially, and yeah. then I did my master's in the LSE. I loved doing those, and at the time, they felt hugely valuable. Unfortunately, with the benefit of hindsight, everything I learnt then turns out to be pretty useless. And not because my education and my tutors weren't good, but because economics has changed. And
mm-hmm.
back in those days, in fact, then and still now, most businesses, most economic theory is based on a set of assumptions. And those assumptions are that as businesses, as business leaders, as consumers, as buyers and sellers, we behave rationally. There's this rational assumption, and therefore that we get optimal outcomes through market forces. That would be fine if there were any evidence that people actually behaved rationally, that decisions were made rationally. But we just assumed they did. We never looked historically at that, whether that assumption was valid. You might think, well, why does this matter in the slightest? Well, a chap called Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize for yeah. economics. So basically saying all of that is wrong. When you study people's actual behavior, most of the time they don't behave rationally. In fact, I would buy his book. It's a heavy read, but all you need to read is the front page. The title of the book, Kahneman's book, he's written many, but the popular one is Thinking Fast and Slow.
Yep.
And really in that phrase, for thinking fast and slow, you get the distinction between slow thinking, which is reasoned, rational, thoughtful, careful decision making, which in fact, all the evidence shows is very, very rare. Very rarely do we do that kind of rational thinking, rational decision making. The fast thinking is what we do most of the time, which is thinking decisions driven by habit, driven by rules of thumb, driven by randomness, or just a whole lot of non-rational stuff. Now, there isn't enough time to rationally evaluate, let's say, the cup of coffee I had this morning, to fully rationalise. There were two in the Sheffield railway station. There were two coffee shops next to each other for me to work out which one was better than the other. It would just take too much time. So I just went to the one that was closest to me. And we make those kind of simple decisions much of the time. But when stuff matters, the future of our business, the future of our planet, for example, boy, wouldn't it make sense to escape that fast-thinking trap
yep.
and move into proper, careful, rational, slow thinking, you know, really think through the issues. And we shall go back to what we said before. You know, in fact, strangely, the session I went to on Wednesday, the whole of the morning, remember when I said I'd got them to do the coffee shop story and go
yep.
to one side of the room or the other, the whole of the morning they've been talking about disaster recovery. The morning was looking at what happens if your building burns down in your business. And this was fascinating stuff and really, really important stuff. You know, what happens to your data and your business continuity and so on. But it struck me sitting there that actually, yeah, one little business goes out, really devastating for that business. But we are facing as a planet the possibility of the equivalent of, you know, it all imploding, either because of environmental damage or political unrest or inequality or, you know, all sorts of stuff that would make those kind of disasters pale into total insignificance.
Yeah.
And yet a bunch of business leaders spent 4 hours thinking really, really carefully about what they were going to do in that situation. rationally, how much more time, how much more care and attention should we think about the bigger issues? It was only a few years ago we had rioting on the streets in this country because a bunch of, you know, a large chunk of younger people felt disenfranchised in the jaws of, you know, the recession, and felt that they had no option, they couldn't get jobs. Then they might as well smash windows in and steal stuff out. If you remember, it was really pretty scary times.
Indeed.
You know, we are still, as a society, as a planet, as humanity, we are still facing so many challenges, and the UN spelt them out brilliantly in the Global Goals.
Yes.
And then immediately there, you know, Richard Branson was there at the launch of those goals saying, governments can't do this alone. We as business people need to step up and step in and do something. So you marry all this stuff together. The economics that I studied then turned out to be irrelevant. What we've actually got to look at is people's real behaviour, and we've got to change real behaviour. We've got to introduce some real rational thinking to the things that really matter. The success of our businesses matter, the success of our families and our communities and our society and the planet matters. So let's each collectively be a bit more rational about that. And let's go back to what I also said. If you then look at the business case for doing good, it's overwhelming.
Yeah.
You look at the humanitarian case, it's overwhelming. Rationally, what should our behaviour become? We should be like the coffee shop, providing water as well as coffee. Rationally, that's what we can do.
Yeah, grand. Indeed, we can. That is what we can do. That is concrete. That is tangible. And interesting as well, it was interesting to see this week the think tank, the IPPR, published a new report, and a lot of business leaders from a range of businesses, from small to very, very large businesses, contributed to that and said, well, we need to think about business in a different way, and in a way that is more positive in terms of societal impact. So that had quite a lot of publicity this week as well. So, and this is Helena Middleton was one of them. Many well-known business leaders of very large businesses as well are saying this and are talking about this. And important.
The real key, I think, though, sorry, excuse me for interrupting, Jamie. The real key is not just to sit round tables talking about it and make great speeches and great declarations of at some point in the future we'll do something. It's to take action now.
It's to do
something now. And we can do something now remarkably simply, remarkably easy, no matter how big or small our businesses are. We can. You know, we might not be able to change our environmental footprint by fundamentally changing the product, you know, the way we manufacture and so on straight away. We might not be able to do it. We probably can't. But straight away, we could start funding water in Africa, for example. I use that as purely as a metaphor for all the other things we could do. There are things we can do straight away. In fact, if you were to ask me what's the one single action changing behaviour that I would encourage anybody to take as a result of our conversation today, it would be to take a... There's B1G1, the people that inspired me, the people that really got me off on this subject, they have a... You can go on their website, and I'm not affiliated, I don't benefit in any way other than as a human being, we all benefit from the world getting better. You can go on their website, put in a few details, and they will spend time creating what they call a giving plan. That's a carefully thought through, personalised for you report that shows you how you could factor your equivalent of water. You're not a coffee shop, and it's probably not water in Malawi, but what's the equivalent that you could do that will have the greatest impact the most easily within your business? They'll do that for you for free. And as a first step, getting one of those giving plans, I think, is, you know, rationally a complete and absolute no-brainer. With your permission, I put a tweet on my @StevePike Twitter account with the link there so people can follow through, get one of those giving plans. Think about, with this some slow thinking then, for sure, rationally, would this make sense for the world? Would this make sense for my business? Would I feel happier if my business were more like that? I think the answer to all of those questions is yes, but take a look. Don't say you'll do it tomorrow, because tomorrow will never come. It's about the behavior. You know, this whole field of economics, by the way, is now called behavioral economics. It doesn't look at theory, it looks at our actual behavior, what we do. And it's what we do that will change the world, not what we think, not what we promise to do sometime down the line, not the think tanks that we contribute to. It's what we do.
Yes.
And that's a brilliant first step.
So you can do something today which will make a difference today. And that's really, really important. That's fabulous. And we will be tweeting out and retweeting your link as well.
Thank you so much.
So that folk can find it. So listeners can make their businesses whether you're running a one-person sole trader business, a social enterprise, a business of a micro enterprise, an SME, a large business, you can make your business a force for good, and you can make that step today. Mm-hmm. And you talked a bit about B1, G1 and the global goals and alignment with the global goals there and an individual giving plan. And so it might be that a listener really, really cares about water and access to clean water. And as you've talked about earlier, if someone has to trek for 2-3 hours to collect water 2 or 3 times a day, they will often miss an education. Mm-hmm. And so if we can provide access to water, what an enormous difference.
Yeah, it just unlocks all that potential for the world, all that talent.
For the world. Mm. And the goals are diverse as well. So it might be that by taking a look, you can find the goal that most resonates with you, with your business and with your personal preferences as well. It might be environmental, it might be about poverty, it might be about education. There are a diverse range of 17 goals.
There are 17 goals. In fact, one of the other wonderful things about the way that B1G1 have structured their approach is that you can search. So if, for example, you're interested in football or music or IT, you can search to find projects that will support someone in those areas.
Yes.
And then you can search by country, you can search by the nature of the projects to support, but you can also search by global goals. So for example, the global goal that was most important to you was equality.
Yes.
You can search for the projects that will contribute towards equality.
Yeah.
So whatever it is that most resonates with you, that touches your heart, where you want to focus on linking your business to in some positive way, you can do that remarkably easily at the push of a button.
Grand. Yeah. Excellent. Well, take a look, and I'm going to get you to flag up links again in a moment or two. But before that, I've got some rapid-fire questions for you, Steve, because we've got something in the region of a few minutes left, not very long. We could go on, and this has been absolutely fascinating. We're going to have to get you back on the show. But I'm going to ask you for some rapid-fire answers to a whole load of questions, because I'd love to get more out of your brain whilst you're here sharing it with us. Can you, first of all, give us some tips for accountants? So we have plenty of accountants listening to the show. So what are your top tips for accountants?
If we go back to the fact that rational decision-making isn't the normal behaviour for most people, including business owners, our job as accountants is to support our clients making more rational decisions, give them better data, do better analysis of that so they can make better decisions, because when they, with our help, make better decisions, then they build better businesses, better lives, and we create a better world collectively. So I think that's the new focus for the accounting profession. But if you couple that with helping our clients understand that their businesses can be a force for good and there's a commercial case for doing that, then what we as accountants can do is help our clients build fundamentally better businesses in every sense, better for them and better for the world. And I think that's a fantastic new role for the profession compared to keeping the score and auditing that we used to do in the past.
Okay, grand, excellent. And some people say you're the world's most highly rated accountant. You've had hundreds of LinkedIn testimonials, more than any other accountant in the world. How did that happen?
That's very kind of people to say those kind of things. Yeah, I have just over 500 testimonials where people have taken the time and trouble to go onto LinkedIn and say nice things about what I've done for them. And I think the key to that is really, really simple, which is do good things, and then having done good things, ask other people whether they would be kind enough to give you a testimonial. That's what I do. So when someone says to me, that was fantastic, that was really useful, thank you, I say, would you mind help other people understand if you said a few words on LinkedIn? And so people do, 500 times over.
Wonderful.
And if you think about TripAdvisor, I would, if I was coming to Shefford and wanted a meal and I don't know the restaurants, I will look on TripAdvisor. And as professionals and as business people, there isn't necessarily a TripAdvisor for each of our sectors, but LinkedIn allows us to get the same kind of positive testimonials as TripAdvisor does for our restaurants and hotels. So that's the way I think of it. The more of those positive testimonials you've got, the more people will take notice of your message. And if our job is to spread the word about our businesses and what we believe in, then that really helps.
Okay. Brilliant. Now I'm going to have to ask you to do this one really quickly, and I think we'll probably have to come back to it. You've had a number of books published, which we mentioned at the start of the interview, so and you've also recommended some books, including Kahneman, And I know Dan Ariely has done a lot on behavioural economics as well.
So.
Really good. But you're an author yourself. What are your tips for people who want to write a book that is a business book or a social enterprise book, a business that a book that supports their business and life goals?
If you'd love me to come back and talk about that another time in more detail, I'd be happy to do so. Let me just say the one thing. So I've written 7 or 8 business books. Put it into the context, I was completely useless at English at school. At my O-levels, they were by far and away my worst O-levels. I was way better at everything else. So if I can end up going from being useless at English to writing 7 books, then anybody and everybody can. And I think Jane Austen, I mean, I didn't never study Jane Austen because I was useless at English, so why would I have done? But Jane Austen said something profound which really opened it up to people like me who are useless at English. She said, and she's widely regarded, I'm told, as the best writer of all time, English writer of all time, she said, we should write as we speak. Now, we're not taught to write as we speak. We're taught to write using formal grammar structure and so on. But actually, just like that sentence then, I started that sentence, but actually, and it's a 2-word sentence. If I wrote that in an English class, I would be slated for it. But if you write something like that in books and articles, it actually flows.
It does.
So we should write as we speak. Now, we all speak. And actually, a great way of writing to speak is just record what you say.
Yes.
And then get it transcribed. And these days, technology will do that. And you will be amazed at how much easier it is to write than you dared to imagine, even if you're useless at English, as I indeed am. But once we understand that Jane Austen gave us permission to write as we speak... Back in those days, they would say, my dear sir, and that's why letters start, dear sir. I wouldn't dream of writing a letter, dear sir, unless the recipient expects it, because it's not how we speak now. So that's liberating. We can all write, and if I can, then everybody else can.
If
there's a book in you, get it out. You'll probably find there are 7.
Or more. More to come, I should think. That's a wonderful tip to end on. And let's end with a cliffhanger then. There will be more writing tips in a future edition of Business Live.
I would love to come back
Steve
and share
Clark.
Those if you're happy to have me.
So we've got 30 seconds. I would like you to give out the call to action, which is one thing you should do.
I said it already and I'll say it again at the risk of repeating myself. If any of this resonates with you, get a giving plan. It's completely free. I've tweeted it. Jamie will also kindly tweet it. It will give you a written report explaining how you can build doing good into your business. It will change the way you view your business, change the way you run your business, change the impact you have in your business forever.
Grand. Steve, that's been absolutely fascinating. Check Steve's Twitter at Steve Pipe for the link to get an individual, to get a giving plan for your business. I'll tweet it out from Jamie Veitch. Sheffield Live will as well. Steve, Twitter the best way to talk with you?
That would be great, yeah.
Great, fantastic. Steve Pipe, thank you so much for joining us today.
My great pleasure.
And you've been listening to Business Live, our weekly business and social enterprise programme, with me, Jamie Veitch. Steve Pipe has been our guest. Earlier, we had Madge Willard on the show. It's been a fascinating show, and we'll be back on air next Friday. Next up is our folk music programme. Thank goodness it's folk, on the air from 10 all the way through to noon. So tune in to that. We'll play out with just a few seconds of a track chosen by guest Steve Pipe. This is Heather Small, It's Proud.
Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield. Made by you.